Hi, I'm Pete Cooper, Senior Fellow with the Atlantic Council Cyber Statecraft Initiative. On November the 14th, I was joined by Amy Chang of JP Morgan Chase, Andrea Little-Embargo of Vertrue, Bo Woods of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative. Together we chatted about the human element of cybersecurity. A lot of people would talk about the awareness of users and awareness in cybersecurity, but we didn't bound it and we wanted to see where the conversation would go. And this is now just coming up. So, hi everybody. This is Pete Cooper at the Atlantic Council, and this is a follow-up podcast to the panel discussion we've just held, chatting about the human element of cybersecurity. So, really pleased to have with us on the discussion, we've got Andrea Little-Embargo, who's a computational social scientist at Vertrue. We've got Amy Chang, who's a senior threat intel analyst at JPMC with some really good links into the FS Arc. And also we've got Bo Woods, who's also in the Statecraft Initiative with myself at the Council. We've just had an amazing conversation about the human element on cybersecurity, which touched on a really diverse set of topics, everything from cybersecurity culture in organizations to trying to shape and change behaviors of adversaries into generating the cross-discipline cybersecurity workforce that we need if we're going to start incorporating cybersecurity culture. I'm going to first pass over to Bo, and part of the reason for that is that as much as he's doing a lot of great work on cybersecurity, especially around OT and secure by design, his background also has a degree in psychology, which I sort of want to sort of expand out on that and say, so you've got a background in sort of psychology from your degree program. How have you utilized that and used that through all of your cybersecurity work?
So thanks, Pete. As you mentioned, I've got a degree in psychology from Georgia Tech. So a very human element focus of study from a very technical university. As such, it kind of bridges the gaps. And I think pretty quickly, early on in my cybersecurity career, working at a hospital, the psychology element, the human element became a fundamental part of how I think about doing security, which is, you know, you're walking around and you're seeing patients and they're depending on these life-saving treatments that are coming through medical devices and electronic medical record systems delivered by nurses and doctors. The caregivers themselves can either be bolstered or frustrated by the technology, and some of the security capabilities that you build into it can either help them or get in the way of their workflows. Being able to translate, explain, and connect people with the technology, either in a way that makes it obvious or makes it transparent to them in doing their jobs. Understanding how people are going to see and react to things as either a benefit or a net detractor from what they do, I think is critically important in designing and operating any kind of a system. At the same time, it also helped when I started studying adversary groups, you know, the bad actors, and looking at some of their decisions and choices. And if you've got a person who's an out-of-work software engineer with a PhD living in Odessa who could make $300 to $500 a month by extorting money from somebody on the other side of the world, that's going to allow him to put, you know, shoes on his kids' feet. There's also a psychological and moral question, you know, is he right to do that, or should he let his kids go shoeless through the streets, right? And regardless of what the right answer is in that for the broader society, on an individual level, everybody's going to look out for themselves first, for their families, food, shelter, clothing, that sort of thing. And that's going to drive a lot of behaviors, both in the adversary classes as well as in defenders.
We're very close to talking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs in a cybersecurity yeah. podcast, which is amazing. And it's right, because a lot of that will drive motivations, whether they're the defenders or the adversaries. But what you're picking up on is that transparent cybersecurity, all the work you're doing in the hospitals around cybersecurity and across the medical device manufacturers is actually a doctor or a nurse are focusing on being a doctor or a nurse. They it's hard to make them focus on anything around cybersecurity, which isn't their primary job, because that's a big distraction. Yeah. Going across to yourself, Amy, is that you're trying to get all of your clients to, again, they've got their own lives, that it's doing safe, secure transactions online, they don't want to have to think about that. It's got to be something that irrespective of how good or how not they are about cybersecurity, it's got to be transparent. That human element of designing in the human aspect and allowing for human error and allowing for human behaviors, that's got to be really hard at scale, really. And from an organizational perspective, what are some of the sort of lessons you've seen of that? Because I'm seeing there's a lot of really good parity across both trying to design transparent security for a group of medical users to a group of people in the financial sector.
I would say that, you know, for an organization that has over 250,000 employees, ensuring that everyone, every single one of our employees is cyber aware is obviously a monumental task. And in order for us to kind of generate a culture of cybersecurity awareness and protection, what I have noticed our leadership has done is to kind of generate buy-in and to inspire each of our employees to kind of have a stake in the success of the company. And over the past several years that I've noticed, I've only been with JP Morgan for 1 year, but I've noticed that there is a lot of celebration of successes. There's a lot of celebration of innovation, empowering the employees to be able to take security into their own hands or even come up with new ideas for innovation or unique solutions to the issues that we face in our organization. And I think that taking that approach, not just from the JP Morgan perspective, but being able to apply that as a leader of any organization is an important tool that leaders and even individuals can tap into to kind of boost that morale and buy-in to create and generate sort of a virtuous cycle of security at an organization.
So it's that positive feedback loop into the users, but also I guess the security teams as well to say, look, if you come up with new processes or new tools that are amazing, then we'll reward you for that. So it's not just users, it's everything, I guess.
But also empowering the employees to feel ownership and allow them and give them the latitude to be able to innovate. When you're a financial institution or any sort of major corporation, you have so many regulatory, legal, other types of issues that are more restrictive in nature, and you have to make sure that you follow the standard operating procedures to be able to, you know, ensure that you're not going awry of any sort of regulatory issue. Once you have that squared away, you can find areas of latitude where you're able to kind of give your employees the space to be able to think creatively and find innovative solutions to cyber issues.
All of that is really good, but that's coming from a really forward leadership, and that's coming from an informed leadership. Mm-hmm. How do we make that leadership informed and actually want to drive that forwards? Are we going to have to learn from failure? How can we try and tell companies that this is the right thing to do, to think like this and be forward leaning, so we're not having to sort of basically wait for something to happen before we can have that change? I mean, from your perspective, from the industry, how do you see that, Andrea?
Yeah, I think it goes back to how we, you know, impact human behavior, which is incentives. And so incentivizing, explaining, educating, making sure they understand what the benefits are, what you know, the upside might be, while also explaining what some of the downside may be. I think very often, you know, to the executives, they do get the notion that, you know, if you just buy this black box, everything will be good. And they've been burned so many times that it becomes hard for them to prioritize something that they think they just don't understand. And so I think demystifying is the term, one of those terms that's way overused in cybersecurity, but I think it is adequate for this, and just making it become more accessible, allowing, you know, the tech community to translate better what needs to be done for a broader population, because that impacts not just the executives, but then it also becomes bottom up, where the employees are become better educated, and they can also help encourage the leadership. And so and that way you can have sort of the top down and the bottom up both being incentivized to create and foster more of a culture of cyber awareness.
Okay, so really good point on the incentives. And looking across at Bo and Amy, I mean, both medical and financial sectors are highly regulated. So when we're looking at incentives for improving cybersecurity, certainly I, and not with JP Morgan, by the way, have had the experience where a potential banking consultancy client I was going to work with very much thought from their leadership perspective, which was, once we are compliant, then we're good to go, we're done. And it feels like actually that right now that's not enough. Compliance is effectively step one. We've got to be really pushing on culture. How do we move forwards from a compliance sort of regulatory regime into one where we've got leadership and empowered workforce that really focus on cybersecurity so that compliance is a tick in the box and that we are still really focused on this?
I think some of the missing pieces that exist in industry that are currently, I think, on the trajectory of being patched is that connective tissue, that conduit from the people who are in legal, who are in the regulatory space, who are telling you, you need to check this box in order to be able to, you know, remain compliant and get the government off your back or whatever. And then you have a lot of, if you're talking about cybersecurity, technical people who may not understand the whole picture because they have been taught and trained to focus on protecting this network with this capacity, with this capability. And once you're able to bring in additional human resources who are able to kind of string everything together to influence the culture of an organization all the way up through its leadership, and having those translators and communicators of like why, A, it's important to have these technical people to secure networks, but also extending onward onto like why a culture of cybersecurity awareness and why everyone should feel empowered to be able to buy in and ensure cybersecurity is also important. I think organizations are coming around to understanding the value of those types of people.
Yeah, no,
that makes sense.
Yeah, so we're talking about incentives and regulation being one of the forms of incentives that organizations and individuals will have. I think a lot of times people see regulation as the ceiling, but really it drives them to a floor. So it becomes kind of the minimum viable security system to operate, which then comes down to a cost issue. What's the lowest cost thing we can do to achieve this goal? Even when it is a ceiling sometimes, or when they treat it as a ceiling and they race towards it to improve year over year, not just in terms of compliance, but in terms of actual security, you can sometimes have compliance regimes and regulatory regimes that point in the wrong direction. Kind of the classic example that I reach for, partly because I've got a healthcare background, is the HIPAA Act, which is a Health Information Privacy and Portability Act. I always butcher that. We can look it up and dub it in later. But where HIPAA incentivizes through regulatory levers preserving the privacy and confidentiality of information, it does nothing to the safety of the medical devices themselves. And so you have a situation where privacy is protected under HIPAA, but patient safety and effectiveness of the clinical solutions is not. A similar thing happened with the meaningful use standards in one of the later, more recent acts with HITECH. Essentially, meaningful use incentivized organizations through the use of insurance paybacks and Medicare, Medicaid payback reimbursements to plug in medical devices and other systems that had always been threat modeled to be completely isolated and standalone. Now, you take something that's been threat modeled to be standalone and you plug it into the internet, of course you're going to have security problems, right? So we've got a ton of those things now. So when we look at regulation or you look at any kind of a compliance driver, first of all, it tends to set a floor rather than a ceiling. And it also oftentimes is misaligned to what we need, the different goals that we might actually want to achieve coming out of a security program.
But if governments around the world and different nations are trying to find ways of improving cybersecurity nationally or internationally through partnerships, we're fundamentally turning around here saying, well, if we don't get the incentives right, we're going to be sort of stalled, really, for trying to improve this from a socio model. Is getting these incentives right is going to be essential, and that's a very human element. It's we talk about how can we incentivize the human to do the right thing just naturally because they're thinking about it, well, even because they're not thinking about it, we want them to do it sort of subconsciously, do the safe and secure thing. Any ideas, Andrew, for yourself, is how can we really help governments move potentially away from this? And I love Beau's expression, which is talking about regulation versus a floor versus a ceiling. How do we try and move away from this compliant driver into something that looks more like a have a really great and powered cybersecurity culture and keep driving risk down as low as you can for your business.
Yeah, I think I'll probably return again to the top down and bottom up. The boards are becoming more educated, and so the boards are influencing much more so the leadership to care about it. And so that is starting to have some traction, and which gets back into the education and, you know, moving beyond thinking about security as just a tech problem and as a broader business risk imperative. And so that's one aspect from a top down. But when companies treat culture of any kind as a check the box kind of thing, and that in tech and security, I think it's especially problematic, where we see a lot of sort of check the box by leadership trying to change culture of a variety of kinds. It's when it really fails, and that, you know, it's easier just to throw money at something, check a box saying you did that, and move on. And that's what happens quite frequently. And so instead, we need to actually think about the educational aspect, making sure what we're doing for cultural shifts is actually something that will remain ingrained within the workforce versus just the slides that you click through after 5 minutes and you check the box saying that you're done and you're trained. Those are sort of the legacy aspects that are still persisting. But I do think, you know, in some areas, you know, we're basically, you know, experimenting right now. You know, we're in an area that's a fair amount unknown. Doesn't mean that we can't build from other areas and do the right thing in that area, do the right thing as far as trying to make cultural changes within companies. But, you know, I think we're going to start talking about or start seeing some more regulations. And again, just even, you know, from the international level, there is that push, you know, from GDPR, from the latest California Act. A lot of those focus more on privacy, which then still need to understand how they're going to have a security component as well. And so the privacy aspect is absolutely essential, especially as we're seeing other governments trying to consume as much data as possible. But looking at how those regulations also balance privacy and security, and not necessarily having to give those as a toss-up. I mean, that's one of the big debates that we see right now, is that there's, you know, that some trade-off between, you know, convenience and privacy and security, and whether that trade-off has to exist or not. And so, again, that's where it's going to take a tech solution. It's going to take a human element to move forth in that area. So I think we can get there. I think, again, it's a combination of incentives, of the technology, of businesses better understanding what's in it for them, even absent regulations, right? And so they don't want to be the next name on the New York Times as far as the big breach that just occurred. And we're seeing the C-suite starting to lose jobs from various breaches. And so on the one hand, those are sort of negative repercussions from it, as opposed to the positive ones that actually can help build up the culture. But I think we're going to start seeing it's that those combinations are really starting to push the envelope forward and making it much more so, you know, a top priority within corporations.
Yeah, I want to riff on this for just a second, if I can. So, you know, we talked a little bit in the pre-conversation about products available on the market. And in a lot of cases, we know better and worse things to do. We don't always necessarily apply them. While we don't know everything to do perfectly, we at least know a lot of the things to avoid as known pitfalls, but we don't. So we've got a good body of knowledge to draw on. We just don't, for some reason, incentivize following those good practices, those known good practices in design, development, as well as operation and maintenance. And I think that part of that comes down to awareness. You know, people aren't always aware that we have good practice. Part of it also comes down to broader scale incentives, not at the organizational level, but at the broader economy level, right? So most of the information that decision makers read come in the form of white papers from vendors, right? White papers from vendors may be, you know, the best, highest quality work that there is, but it will have a certain perspective and it will be driven by a certain set of incentives, which is to return on the investment of the funders of the product company. That leaves a huge gap, which is the things for which there is no venturable market. In other words, nobody's going to fund somebody to say, let's go change our passwords. Like, there's not a product that will do that, really. If there is, I don't know about it. And it's probably not something where you can get 100x return on your investment as an angel investor, right? So there's a lot of things that just don't have an incentives model that works. And since there's not an inherent awareness, knowledge, and understanding of how to apply that, you get essentially broken systems. People ask, you know, is this a market failure? Have we just failed to incentivize the right things? Or, in other words, does there need to be some external regulatory pressure to push people towards better behaviors? And I'm not sure whether it's a market failure or whether it's just a very immature market, but you have things like a high degree of information asymmetry, whether you're talking about penetration testing on the security side or some of the aftermarket security products, or some of the products themselves, right? If I wanted to go out and buy a car that's more secure versus less secure, I can't. And I know some of the people doing security at those car companies, right? What hope does my mom have or does my neighbor have? The same thing is true across many different verticals, you know, whether you look at healthcare and medical devices, whether you look at accounting software or whatever. So we can't tell better from worse product security on the market. Secondly, we can't account for true cost and risk. So I don't know what it's going to cost me to secure that thing before I buy it. How can I possibly make an informed decision about even the cost of owning and operating it, right? And then once I do, I have a certain amount of risk that I can or won't tolerate, but I don't know what that level is going to be and whether this product is going to support or get in the way of my hitting that goal. So essentially what that leads to is companies that either apply all the security they can once they buy something, which tends to be wasteful in terms of cost, or they apply very little security, which leaves them open to a lot of risk. And there's other systemic risk like DDoSes and botnets and things like that. Very few companies, the very large ones, can do this, but to accurately gauge cost and risk at time of buying or after, to factor that in. And then a third characteristic of a lot of software and IoT and other products that we buy is, if I do buy it and through no fault of my own, something happens and I come to harm, there's no liability in the equation. So there's nobody accountable. Essentially, I'm responsible for all the costs of my own losses, and no one else in the ecosystem can take those. And that's a decision that we've made as a society to kind of stimulate the growth of software because there's a lot of huge potential. But at a certain point, we trip a threshold where the cost of harm, potential harm, outweighs the cost potential of having essentially no defined rules of the road, responsibilities, and liability throughout the supply chain and chain of operations.
A lot of the stuff you're talking about there is, how can we make organizations, empower the organizations to do the right thing, to buy the right hardware, to use the right software, and to monitor that. And that's all coming down to buying something or using something or buying a service for something. Whereas for a lot of the stuff that we're talking about on culture, that's almost free to a certain extent, because it comes down to an empowered leadership, an empowered workforce. The CEO turning around saying, right, we're going to have a good cybersecurity culture where we've got an empowered workforce, we learn from our mistakes. You don't have to buy anything to do that.
Yeah.
And so I always feel like that we've put ourselves down the road where, from a cybersecurity industry perspective, we're selling that good is you have to buy some stuff. And actually, I think we need to try and do something to try and change that perspective.
Yeah, so I could have flipped the two parts of that mini rant, which the first part was about, we know how to do better, we just don't. The second part is, when we're buying the inevitable things that we must buy, like a car, some piece of software, non-security software, but the IT, the business enabling piece, we can't adequately account for cost, risk, and any of the other things that we might normally do when we're buying other office equipment, right? So at a business level or a personal level, we're unable to see it and make good decisions. Therefore, we get stuck in this mentality of, we've got to buy something afterwards to then apply, because we can't know what we have to do to secure it when we go to buy it.
And then moving on to thinking more about the adversary, we had a lot of really good feedback from people saying, oh, we haven't really thought about the adversary as a human to a certain extent. And actually, I mean, that's your world. You have to think and get into the adversary psychology, their approach, their methodology, all the time, with the scale of the what you're defending and the range of the threats that you've got against you. Who are your really good partners in that sort of in that effort as you're going forwards? Because from what I can see, the more organizations we can get thinking like that, the better prepared we're going to be internationally. Or do you see yourselves as out there, really? Or are there a lot of people doing this now?
I think for large organizations, they have come around to understanding more of the nature of the adversary and the threat that they face. I think that it's very difficult when, you know, we're talking about all these products and all these vendors and all this information that's coming at these organizations, and you have, you know, our C-suite reading the New York Times and all this and the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, all these types of these publications, and watching CNN and getting all this influx of information about all the things that are threatening our economy, our organizations, our government, our supply chain, things like that. And they become really overwhelmed. And they're like, okay, well, we need to be worried about Russian interference too. And, you know, that's not necessarily even the right mindset to approach security at your organization. So I think one of the primary steps that needs to happen from an organizational perspective is to kind of understand what are the key threats to your organization. Where do you have vulnerabilities? Where do you have strengths? And what kind of considerations do you need to make to be able to mitigate that threat that's presented to your firm? And that is something that I think that a lot of larger organizations can afford to invest in. Though I think that that's a cultural decision that all organizations need to make in order to make smart decisions about the very limited resources that they have, whether it be money, human capital, time, and then to be able to kind of direct that energy in a way that is most efficient and most cost effective. In terms of other partners in this space for the financial sector, we have a lot of cross-sector mechanisms to be able to collaborate with other financial institutions. You have the FSISAC, and then you also have a new organization that was created 2 years ago called the FSARC, which stands for Financial Systemic Analysis and Resiliency Center. And these are where the top financial institutions who are working together with the U.S. government through this mechanism of the FSARC to be able to collaborate and understand this sort of systemic risks to the financial sector. North Korea may want to target a specific bank, but what if they just want to, you know, what if we impose some sort of crippling sanctions where they just want to take out the entire financial sector? What then? You know, like JP Morgan may be able to defend itself, but if another organization in the same financial sector gets their infrastructure hit, and we're all interconnected, and how are, you know, that doesn't really make us any better off than any other financial institution. So having a mechanism and a forum such as the FSARC in place is able to allow these entities to be able to collaborate. So I think it's a very useful entity to have to kind of foster that partnership and collaboration, to kind of look at risk from a systemic perspective, and to be able to leverage the different types of resources and tools that each organization, whether it be from the private sector or for the government, has to kind of work together to build resilience and to build awareness.
But it's interesting, all of that is coming down to risk. And I always think about risk as being a perception. So it's your perception of risk. And a lot of that will come down to heuristics and biases of how that is being perceived, because it's a human perception. What I quite like about all of the approach you've got with the collaboration is you might have one organization that's got a perception of risk to do with a threat actor, which looks like A, and then the other organization has a perception of the risk, which looks like B. And the collaboration helps give a better, more holistic view of that risk. So that, I think that's the real strength of collaboration. And then also from a national perspective, the better the collaboration there, then when it comes to understanding the systemic risk, then all of those organizations, all of that information sharing helps actually give a much better and truer view of that risk. So that nationally and internationally, especially for things like SWIFT and things like that, we're much, much better protected. But I mean, when it comes to sort of viewing systemic risk and viewing the perceptions of it and how, let's face it, perception is easily swayed, literally by what is in the headlines one day and what isn't in the headlines the other day. How do we refine and improve this perception of risk? And I'll hand that to yourself.
Yeah, I think, again, it's back to, from the security community, doing a better job translating that risk to the various industries. I mean, I think certain industries are farther ahead because they've been dealing with it a bit longer. Thinking about, you know, it was just a year ago when I was talking to a political campaign, who didn't understand why they might be a target. And so, again, this was, you know, year after, you know, 2016, these are bright, educated people that understand, you know, what, you know, national security and so forth, but still didn't quite understand why they might be a target. That's just one example. You know, I had something similar with an oil and gas company. So really, I think we're feeling and just translating what that risk may be, because I think it is like what we were talking about, as far as there's so many headlines and there's so much information overload that people just tune it out. And again, it gets into sort of the psychology of it, is that when there is all this information overload, you know, the easier thing to do is just to kind of turn it off. It's similar to alert fatigue for analysts that are actually working within the SOC. The executives are also getting the same kind of information overload. And so, you know, it's hard for them to understand. It's almost easier just to, you know, hope it doesn't happen to them than actually do something about it. But I think if we do a better job informing, even just at the level as far as here are some of the basic best practices, because we do know what those are, like Will said, but a lot of people still outside of our security community don't know what they are. And even though every October we'll write, you know, every vendor will write the top 10 things people can do, it's pretty much talking to ourselves in those areas. And so the more that we can get that out there, the better off we are. I mean, the best example, you know, is someone from Google gave a talk earlier this year that 10% of Gmail users use two-factor authentication. And I talked about this when I was on a panel with some military folks, and one of them flat out said, well, it's because it's too hard to use. And so, again, so you got the convenience factor. Is it really too hard to use given what you may get in return? But the perception is there that it's too hard to use. And I'm not guaranteeing, yeah, I can't guarantee they actually even tried using it because it's not that hard to use, but there's a perception there that it is. And so there's all these issues that we need to overcome in that area. But I think that the more that we can make this more consumable to the broader society, I think the better off we are.
When we're talking about that perception of risk, I mean, when I go into an organization to talk about their cybersecurity, I will literally sit down and have a coffee with as many people as possible just to chat to them and to understand how they're approaching it and what the perception's like and what the culture's like. And one of the companies I spoke to, it was interesting, the completely different perspectives from the bottom of the organization to the top of the organization. So at the top of the organization, it said, well, how did you get on with all of the ransomware that's been going on and all of the attacks of that nature? And the seniors were saying, well, it's amazing. We dodged a bullet. It was, we did really well as an organization. We're pretty well sorted here. The same conversation with the SOC, and the SOC were turning around saying, literally, we wish we'd been slammed. We wish that we'd actually had an outage for a period of time, because at that stage, the senior leadership would then listen to us about the challenges we've got. Because at the moment, they didn't feel listened to, and they were almost, and at lower levels of the organization, they were looking for failure as the way to help educate the senior leadership, which is not sustainable. So fundamentally, for the cybersecurity challenge we're facing, is this is not just about the best technology, not just about the best software. It's, how do we make these messages land with the right people in the right leadership positions to be able to do something about it? And Bo, you're nodding as we're talking.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of organizations, security messaging that trickles up to the top layer is based on heroic efforts at the bottom layer rather than sustained systemic good practices, right? And that's not sustainable. As much as we all want to be a hero every day, to actually do it is friggin' exhausting. And you really quickly burn out. And then you're on to something else, right? You're going to drop out of the organization. You're going to become less effective. And I think that stratification and the lack of capability, as well as common frames of reference to translate up the chain, is something that it will change over time. In 50 years, we probably won't have the same problem. Probably have different problems, but it won't be the same problem. We'll have figured that part out, I hope. And I think to tie this a little bit back to the conversation on risk, a lot of times we use mental models. So what is your mental model for the way your air conditioner works at home, right? And is that the same mental model for how your air conditioner works in your car? Because they're actually different fundamental modes of operation. And we studied this case in some of my psychology classes, and it's really instructional because when you talk to senior leaders and ask them what their mental model is for risk, they have a whole different mental model than someone else who might be in the same conversation. So when each of them hear the word risk, their mental model takes them in a totally different direction. And you see this at the national and public policy layer when policymakers say, you must make decisions based on risk. CEOs look at them and say, of course, what do you think, I'm an idiot? If I don't make decisions based on risk, I go to jail because I don't look out for the best interests of my stakeholders. But what the public policymaker was not thinking is, hey, you better base your risk on risk to your stakeholders from a financial dip through some cybersecurity means. The policymaker is thinking risk to the public trust in your sector from a destabilizing event that is across all of the companies, right? So whenever people are talking about risk, they tend to use it differently based on their mental model. And if you don't have the ability to translate mental models up and down, you don't have similar or the same mental models, then a lot of information is going to get lost just because of what you assume when you're talking is heard the same way by the person who's listening.
And that shared mental model across the organization, I think, is really important, because then if the organization knows all of the risks it's facing and then it's that feeling of everybody being in the same boat, that everybody has to work hard at it. And that's why I was sort of heartened by, Amy, what you were saying about the approach Jimmy Morgan has, which is, right, this is everybody's problem and we're all working on the same challenge. And I go back to my sort of my first world, which is aviation. And we look at effectively flight safety and safety management systems, which is everybody has a role to make sure that we stay safe. And actually, stratification of a hierarchy and stuff like that is never a reason to not highlight something which is unsafe. Mm-hmm. And there are always channels and communication, ways of communicating with senior leadership of something here is unsafe. And then there's good feedback there for, thanks for highlighting that. We will work on it. We will check it. We will dig into some root cause analysis and then give you some cred for raising it. And I think we're sort of missing that a little bit in this whole sort of cybersecurity world, is we're not valuing and trying to break down some of those values. So we've got a more holistic view of risk. And finally, I'll just sort of throw it open to all of you to sort of, before we sort of bring it to a close, but is there anything that actually we can give as tangibles or anything that we think we haven't covered as we go through? Or are we there? We're trying to fix the world here by just thinking better and having better understanding of risk and the human element. It feels to me like there's a massive opportunity for improving cybersecurity. It feels to me that it's cheap and easy to do because it just takes leadership and a bit of vision and a bit of understanding of what a good culture looks like. So how can we take this forward?
So we talk about a huge workforce gap between being able to fill the right roles with the right people and not having enough. So like, what do we do to fill the workforce gap? And I've heard proposals. For instance, in healthcare, the HHS task force report said something like 75 or 85% of healthcare organizations don't have a single person to do IT or IT security stuff, right? It's a huge workforce gap. So what were the proposals? All right, we'll take a nurse, we'll give her a weekend course, and then she'll be a cybersecurity expert, or he'll be a cybersecurity expert. Unfortunately, that's just not the way it works. But when you have those types of ideas percolating up and you have those types of practices that can be done in other industries, maybe not in a weekend, but you know, in 2 to 4 weeks, you can give somebody a pretty good boot camp in accounting, for instance. That puts us at a severe disadvantage. At the same time, working with a lot of people who are trying to get hired into the industry, but they can't, you know, they may have 10 years of experience doing IT work, but none of their titles said security. And so they can't apply to a position that may be listed as entry level, but you know, requires 5 years of experience with a job title in security. So there's a huge translation gap, even in workforce, that we need to figure out how to overcome. And as one takeaway, for people who have open job recs, if you just get all the resumes and parse through them yourself rather than having HR do the first pass, you'll find a lot of hidden gems. You'll find a lot of diamonds in the rough. People have been doing security, but they don't have whatever checkbox HR is requiring. That's a good step. Also, reaching out to the broader security community. There's a lot of people who go to, for instance, B-Sides events, who have a strong passion for security, but no relevant work experience on paper, but have been doing amateur penetration testing for a long, long time in their own homes, or who have, you know, set up, deployed, and configured networks securely within an organization as a non-security person. So I think there's a lot of untapped potential in there, and it's about bridging the gap. One last thought on workforce is, if we've got a big workforce problem, we're always looking for ways to be more efficient with our security. So we add technology to the problem space in order to reduce the need for manpower. But what actually happens is you add complexity to a system. Whenever you add any complexity to a system, you need more overhead for management. So we're actually exacerbating the problem in a lot of cases. So one way to simplify that is drawing back on something we talked about earlier. Do the simple free things first that are people and process driven before you reach for the thing that will make it more complex with a technology addition to your technology stack.
No, I agree with that. And layer in that actually is there are lots of disciplined stovepipes that all touch on cybersecurity. The more that we can demonstrate the value of all of those different disciplines and start them working together across those stovepipes and break those stovepipes down, I think the better it will be for the industry. But it's demonstrating the value of those different stovepipes, like the psychology, and then understanding the adversary through either the psychology of the adversary or the psychology of the workforce or the psychology of the decision-making at senior levels. But how many cybersecurity teams have got a psychologist on board? And we need to try and distill out what we think would be best practice and then try to make that something that, that can happen more naturally. But that will only work if we can start diversifying the workforce out there.
We talked about this time in the panel, but just to pile on to what Bo was saying, as far as the job descriptions, because that I think as an industry and as you know, the broader across the various sectors, we're just completely shooting ourselves in the foot. I mean, we have this big gap that I hear it's out there, but at the same time, I speak to and know many people that are looking for jobs. And so we really, it's on the corporations to take some time and actually look at how they're defining their job descriptions, how they're writing it, what length of requirements they're looking at, and then actually putting it in places where the right people might look at it as well. And then also being more open to junior level or entry level positions. Because again, a lot of people come in with a ton of experience, but they just have not been, you know, however many years at a certain corporation. And so the more that organizations are flexible as far as hiring and looking at skill sets and critical thinking and teamwork, some of the other aspects that really are what make a security team successful, I think the better off we are. And then by switching that mindset as well, the issue of burnout, which we didn't talk about much, really is a big, big challenge in our industry. I mean, we talk about the pipeline all the time, but we really skip over the retention and we're losing people. And so if we're spending all this time through the training, making sure they're getting the right education, that even if we do all this great interdisciplinary training, when they get into their jobs, they don't want to stay anymore because of that burnout, because it is almost everything we've talked about so far as the executives have a different idea of what they're doing. They're constantly doing work that in many cases, especially at the entry level, might be somewhat tedious. And so the more that we can leverage technology in a beneficial way to help them progress towards more critical thinking in their solutions, the better off we are. And it's sort of moving away from the mindset of what a failure is and what success looks like, because that also contributes to the burnout. And so again, that all goes back to the culture of security and goes back to having organizational, similar organizational understanding across the board as far as what the teams do. I think all that can help ameliorate some of the challenges that we have once we actually get people into this workforce as well.
No, amazing point. And I completely agree on that.
To go back to one of the earlier points that Andrea made, that corporations should open up the aperture on the types of the backgrounds that they would accept. I think on the other side, that there also needs to be some sort of industry-wide initiative to promote diversity in the cybersecurity field, because you watch TV, you listen to these people, you read quotes from newspapers, and they're the same type of people. They fit the quote unquote typical hacker cyber guy dude who's like super like knee deep in like the code and like understands like what goes where and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at the people in this room, we all have very diverse backgrounds. We all bring something to the table, and we are able to bring and add value to each of our respective organizations. And to like promote the diversity and promote the presence of different types of people in the cybersecurity industry, it will show other people outside that a career in cybersecurity is possible for them.
Yeah, and actually that's why, and I mentioned it earlier, which is the Cyber 912 challenge that the Atlantic Council do. And I was really passionate about trying to get the policy and strategy skills more awareness of their value. And the first one that we held in BT Tower in London back in February, it was great. We pulled from humanities, we pulled from business, comms, law, and technical backgrounds, great mixed discipline teams. And it was amazing. It was amazing to watch. But one of the things that I sat there and thought, we've still got so much more work to do, was one of the competitors came up to me afterwards and said that, thanks very much, it's been an amazing experience. It's the first time that as a sort of humanities discipline sort of student, that my value and my passion for cybersecurity has ever felt valued. And I sat there and thought, this is amazing. And I always thought, sort of going, my work here is done. And then there was a follow-up question, which was, and what do I do now? Mm-hmm. And I sat there and that's when I thought, actually we have so much more work to do, because we're hopefully going to try and create this push from all of these amazing students that have got passion for cybersecurity. But if we want them to connect with the industry, if we don't want them to burn out because they can't connect their passion with an employer and a role that really works for them, we've got to create the linkages and the pathways between where they are now and where they want to be in the industry. And that's a much more holistic challenge that we really need to tackle.
to make a quick distinction between the industry who gets hired and the community, the latent talent of passionate individuals. You know, I know at least some of us go and hang out at crazy places like DEF CON and B-Sides and other places where it's really more of the what I would consider the community side. And you see a massive amount of diversity. I don't just mean blue mohawks, right? I mean gender diversity that's much greater than in the industry as a whole. I'd say that there's more people of color in the community rather than in the industry. There's also a huge diversity of backgrounds that doesn't get highlighted in the industry, but is in the community, right? I mean, just looking around this table, I see a sociologist, a psychologist, forgot what you studied, but it wasn't computer science until later on. I don't know your background, public policy, international relations. So there's a huge amount of diversity out there, but we don't tend to favor it, even when we do hire those people in industry. But that certainly goes into a lot of the work that gets done within the community, bringing people together at like the DEF CON villages. And I think one of the things that I would like to see happen, and I'm trying to make happen, is to see that greater diversity reflected in some of the media zeitgeist. So I've got a panel out at South by Southwest next year on the changing perceptions of hackers in media and film throughout the last like 30 years, right? You know, you go back to something like War Games and you had a certain stereotype or two or three different stereotypes of hackers. And even though it was probably pretty good for its time with the main character, a lot of the others were just typecast, right? They were total stereotypes. You move forward to something like Mr. Robot today, each one of the characters is really dense and reflects a certain type of personality, a certain type of motivation that exists in the community as well as the industry. And I think we're starting to see changes there. As we do, we're starting to see more people feel empowered to enter that community and enter that industry. Say, I feel reflected on the film and in news reports, so I can go and do this and I can go and achieve that. And I want to see a lot more of that.
I'm just double checking if anyone's got a book or a film coming out they want to promote, like Bo is promoting about.
Go drop $2,000 to come out to South by. No, don't definitely don't do that. You'll just make my hotel costs go up. But
it's a great point. And actually, yeah. We've already talked about your panel at South by you've got coming up, and it is amazing because it will help discuss what that diversity looks like. And it is good. We have to change that perception of what is a valuable skill in the industry. And it would be really nice. And I think you mentioned Andrew in the pre-chat, which is when people start talking to you and they say, oh, it's really nice to have it's amazing to have a really sort of good sort of senior female in the industry here. And it's just like, it'd be really nice if we can start moving away from that having to be a discussion point at the start. And we can just have this as a completely transparent, we don't care what your background is. We don't care what your gender is. We don't care what the color of your skin is, anything like that. It's what can you bring to the table that is valuable for the industry, and we can get the industry responding to that and hiring irrespective of all of those backgrounds and just go to where the value is. I'd absolutely love that. So there you go. And that would give us a lot more diversity of viewpoint, diversity of approach, diversity of everything really, which gives us that much better holistic solution that we're looking for. That almost feels like a nice place to wrap up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Andrea at Little Embargo, thank you very much. Amy Chang and Bo Woods, thank you very much. I'm Pete Cooper, and this has been a podcast on the human element of cybersecurity.
But we weren't quite done there. I also spoke with Sean Berg of Forcepoint for a longer one-on-one, and we took a deeper dive on this issue and all the potential and challenges about dealing with the human element of cybersecurity.
Now, Sean, you and I spoke in Washington on an amazing panel about this. One of the fascinating things for me that came out of that panel was how wide and how deep the conversation went when we started talking about the human element. I mean, how did you sort of feel about it? I mean, from your perspective, you're dealing with this day in, day out with clients and who you're working with. Is that what you're seeing as well out across the industry and across clients?
Yeah, absolutely. I think certainly that day when we had such a diverse panel to discuss about it, we touched on all aspects of this challenge, which is very interesting to me and opened my eyes towards a lot of new things. Now, from a cybersecurity industry perspective, the human element of cybersecurity hasn't been a huge point of focus up until now. I think the industry is waking up and recognizing that the human element can't be a bystander here. It has to be core to or how we leverage technology to identify the adversaries and the threats and how we address them. I mean, when you think about what you're trying to protect in an organization, whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a government entity or a public sector organization, ultimately it comes down to two things: the people, your employees, and trying to protect them, and as well as the critical data. The traditional mindsets of looking at this problem as an external threat centric challenge that has to be solved at the boundary just doesn't hold water anymore. So I think, the only way to really go after this challenge is to understand what your people are doing, what data they're interacting with, and using that as the key lever in identifying the risks to your organization.
But why now, do you think? I mean, from my perspective, sort of looking out across the industry, I'm starting to see that organizations are getting fairly tired and cynical to an extent of technical solutions and these the technical magic bullet which will make a difference. They've tried that and it's not really worked for a lot of organizations, and now people are now starting to start talking about this human element. Is that what you think is driving this change?
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, just the tens of billions of dollars that are spent annually. I think some estimates are up to $100 billion spent annually on cybersecurity. And yet the breaches, the disruptions, the penetrations are ever increasing and the cost of breaches are increasing. So I think, CISOs across the globe and, individuals across the globe, companies across the globe are tired of this. They spend more and more money, and the risks and the costs and the data loss just increases. So I think they're looking for new and innovative solutions to go at this problem. And fundamentally, they all recognize that this isn't just a technology problem. This is a problem that transcends technology and technical solutions and actually has to enlist everyone associated with the organization to combat, this ever accelerating changes. I mean, we're in this escalating battle between, the adversaries and the people that are trying to protect their networks, and the traditional mechanisms of leveraging technical solutions to address this just, they don't work like they used to. So I think, people, organizations want to enlist, their front line, their employees to help them address this challenge, because they recognize that it's not just a technical challenge. It's a challenge that transcends all aspects of their organization.
There's a great quote from somebody whose name escapes me, which is really frustrating, but it's, don't just see the person within your organization as a weakness. They're a sensor at your network, an amazing one and a cheap one at that as well.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Just awareness alone, they say upwards of 43% of data breaches last year were social attacks, right? Therefore, you could address 43% of the attacks on your organization by merely educating people on what to do and how to react to those challenges. I mean, human nature is always going to be one of the long poles in the tent in cybersecurity. And the better you can get at enabling your workforce to be that front line, it, I think, is money well spent.
And just picking up on some of the sort of themes you were saying there is that, because we're talking about both culture and awareness. I mean, I'm a real fan of helping organizations with cybersecurity culture, which is coming from the CEO and board down through the organization. But again, there's quite a few people now that I think are seeing that, right, we need to think about the human element of cybersecurity. We need to increase training and awareness for the team. But what's the balance, really, of, in your opinion, of looking at the, right, we need to improve the culture of how we think about this problem, and then also tackling the awareness challenge for the staff? I mean, how do we drive and educate the industry to sort of better understand that?
I mean, it's a difficult thing, right? And it takes a village to accomplish this. This is not something, you know, that you can say, hey, do your 1.5 hour of cybersecurity training every year and expect people to adopt that and deal with that. I mean, I think one of the big areas that the industry is trying to address is how do we leverage, you know, human behavior in the efficacy of technical solutions to address the cybersecurity challenges. And what I mean there is how do you leverage analytics and understanding what normal human behavior is on a network and then use that data to identify anomalies where you can then focus your resources, you know, at where the riskiest individuals, the risk, you know, the most critical data is, and therefore you're not applying a single cybersecurity policy across everybody in an equal fashion. I mean, one of the biggest challenges in cybersecurity policies as it intersects with humans is that, you know, the more onerous the policies that potentially restrict how people conduct their business causes a number of problems. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about here. There's a common security tool called data loss prevention, and it's basically a tool to ensure that certain data, some critical data, doesn't leave your network. Well, in order to do that, if you're applying policies across the entire organization, if you really wanted to restrict, you know, to ensure that the data doesn't, you know, exfiltrate your organization, you have to put pretty onerous and restrictive policies in there, which tends to disrupt people's normal work patterns. Well, when you do that, they typically find a way around it. And when they find a way around it, that causes even more risk to the organization. So from an industry perspective, it's this mix of, you know, educate and make aware, but also introduce technologies that are not overly disruptive to the business practices of the individuals on it. You want to apply policies that are adaptive to your organization and, you know, only are more restrictive on those individuals that operate more risky, you know, in a more risky way, or that data that's more critical to the organization versus a one-size-fits-all type of cybersecurity policy. So yeah, it cuts across everything.
Yeah, no, I think we've really got to work hard on making people think and it being true that the cybersecurity department is not the department that says no all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Because then, yeah, it's going to be, well, I'll just use a USB stick. It'll be much faster.
And people will find a way around, sort of challenge you throw up in front of them.
But,
so you want to make them part of the solution.
But for me, if we are to try and move past that, then it means we need to have a good interactive relationship between the users and the people looking at the security of the users, where it's a productive relationship and engagement. But then that comes down to the very human traits of, can we talk together across different disciplines? Can we talk between technical and non-technical in terminology that people understand and doesn't give them the 1,000-yard stare in 3 seconds? Because until we start having that skill for translation but across those different tribes, we're always going to have this challenge where it's just conflict internally about how we're trying to secure and just do business.
Exactly. Exactly. Everyone has to feel like they're part of the solution.
Yeah.
You know, and not just they're being talked to and, hey, you shall do this and shall not do that.
And that's that empowered culture that I think for me really, really comes down to it. So one of the sort of like topics, a bit large topics at the moment is, hey, let's increase phishing exercises and try to really sort of like see what's going on with the staff and things like that. But again, if you don't do that properly, it's just seen as an annoying test by the staff.
Exactly.
And it proves divisive as opposed to, let's do this in a learning environment with an empowered culture where it's not seen as a bad thing if somebody clicks a link, because let's face it, any suitably motivated adversary will generate a link that anybody will click. What we're trying to do is make this much harder, so it raises the bar, really.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, from a cybersecurity industry perspective, we then look at what are those defenses in depth that you can put in place, those backstops that you can put in place to ensure that if something like that does happen, that were not and those individuals that individual's credentials are compromised, that doesn't, you know, take a negative effect against the company. And, you know, in the process, you know, when employees understand that, you know, the cybersecurity team are there to protect them and ensure that their credentials don't get used in a nefarious way internally within the organization, then that changes the dynamic that, okay, you know, this isn't internally Big Brother watching what I do. This is actually someone trying to ensure that my credentials, my reputation is not tarnished by some nefarious actor that's trying to use my credentials to seek out some information within the organization.
Let's take that further then. So for me, it's sad, but it's quite amusing to watch, which is feels like to me a bit of a blame culture in cybersecurity, especially sort of pointed at users. I can't believe you clicked that link. I can't believe you did that. I can't believe... And then it comes down to the big finger of blame points to the poor user who's probably been given some very little in the way of advice or very poor technology or poor security.
Yep.
How do we try and move past this blame culture to the point that we're supportive? So for me, it's if you've got somebody who's just built out a network and made it go live, 3 o'clock in the morning, they're sitting there going, oh, actually, I've done something wrong. I've got to phone the team and tell them I've done it wrong. Or are they going to feel embarrassed about it? Do you see what I mean? It's how do we make this as open and honest and people go, hey, I've made a mistake, or hey, I've clicked this. I think I've made a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, it's the non-retribution component of it. Yeah. You know, it's the empowerment, you know, of the employees that, hey, you're the first line of our cyber defense and organization. Yeah. You know, we're here collectively to try to ensure that we protect our company's assets. And you know, yeah, that's not a simple thing, because for years and years it's been this culture of blame, and now the stakes have gone up so high and we're in this, you know, cyber arms race that, you know, any new technology gets, you know, counteracted by, you know, nefarious actors coming up with new technologies, that, you know, ultimately organizations need to enlist their teams, their individuals to help in this effort. And, you know, you actually called out perfectly, and it's that you have to address this culture of blame and do it more of a culture, you know, create a more of a culture of empowerment, that they're part of the team that's there to protect the broader organization.
Yeah, and it's there's an academic called James Reason, who I use quite a lot on my cultural aspects. Mm-hmm. But he also talks about things like a questioning culture, where you've got to have your staff able to feel that they can ask questions. Is that really the best way to do this? Should we really make the system go live? Should we really roll out this product and feel empowered so they can do that? But I'll go back to one of your points there that you raised earlier, this idea of this arms race that we're in with the adversaries from we'll patch and fix, they'll come up something new, we'll patch and fix. But when it comes to the technology, for me, the technology is always evolving and always will at an ever-increasing rate. The only constant to me in this entire to and fro is the human element.
Yeah.
So it just seems to me that actually, if we're going to invest in something, the second that you invest in just technology, the value of that technology for your defense goes down over time, whether you like it or not. Yeah. Whereas if you invest in the people, especially for culture and things like that, then that will go up over time. And if you look at that from a sort of budgetary point of view for investment, I don't really think that as an awareness is hitting very many sectors at the moment. Because if you walk around all of the big conferences, then it's buy this widget, it'll make you safe. And it comes with a big ROI for whoever's developing it, and that's great. But we need to be incorporating the human element a lot more, because that brings long-term increase in value.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't get solved by adding one new piece of software, right? You know, one more, you know, endpoint on a system that's going to be monitoring X, Y, and Z. This has to be any sort of solution out there in order for it to maintain its efficacy needs to understand the human aspect, the human role in there, in the whole process there. The challenge here is the money spent towards the preventative, the education and things like that isn't as sexy, doesn't have this neat technical wrapper to it, and therefore, you know, it gets discounted when compared to, you know, oh, buy this new capability, put it on the network, and it solves for X, Y, and Z, or the big buzzwords of AI and machine learning. You know, if it doesn't have that, then it can't work in this environment, or its efficacy will be low. And, you know, the reality of it is, it takes all of the above to, you know, improve your defenses and be somewhat resilient to this never-ending arms race that occurs out there. But, you know, I agree with you. It's the individual training and participation of the employee that's ultimately has a big impact on how you can defend against this never-ending race between the cyber criminals and the technologies that are out there.
So let's talk about this. I mean, we've talked a lot about the defensive perspective, and one of the bits that I found fascinating about the Washington panel was, especially with the FBI perspective, is thinking about the adversary as a human as well. I mean, they make mistakes, they have their quirks. What does that give us as defenders, as potential usable defensive aspects? So for me, it's things like, well, they make mistakes as well. They've got biases. They've got traits and habits and tells. Yeah, exactly. So how can we best leverage that, do you think, and leverage them as the human instead of just playing technical whack-a-mole with them?
Well, I think, you know, you leverage the behaviors of the adversaries as a means of protecting yourself in the same way as the same types of tools you leverage to, you know, from a defensive perspective. The human adversaries out there have approaches to things that give tells, and that you leverage those tells, whether it's in a, you know, an antivirus signature or a malware signature that you can leverage in order to protect against an organization or a network, or you know, leveraging analytics, internal analytics, to understand if it's, you know, behavior of a typical, you know, of malware or other types of nefarious pieces of software on your network, that to identify those things, to identify those based on, you know, their anomalous behavior to what should be occurring on the network. So in a lot of the same ways as you would leverage, you know, people within your organization, what is normal there, you would leverage, you know, to understand what is abnormal coming from the adversaries out there. Because again, you know, they're human and you know, they tend to act that way and cause, in, you know, act in an abnormal fashion when they're trying to cause harm.
Yeah, so it's this predictability and unpredictability that sort of slightly fascinating is that, mm-hmm. that actually we can start looking at what behavior and what things we might be able to see. So for me, it's if we've got an adversary that's coming in to attack the organization, can we not just see them through tells, but can we influence their behavior? So there's lots of really quite interesting aspects on deception at the moment is, mm-hmm. what can we present? And the way I talk about it is through a frame. What you frame to that actor is what they draw conclusions on. So what can we show them that will then change their conclusions and influence their behavior, which is quite a fun way of looking at it. How can we get them to zig when they want to zag and make them think it's a really good idea?
I think you see a lot in technology today, the use of honeypots and, you know, the use of controlled areas within a network to try to understand what the adversaries are trying to do before you take a countermeasure at them, right? Yeah. So sandboxes and honeypots to give them something so you can actually look at the malware, understand what the signature is before you shut it off, and not just sit there and try to stop everything from coming in.
Yeah, but even before that, I mean, I quite like thinking about it as if somebody's doing recon on you, they'll come to a conclusion and they'll have five different options of trying to achieve what whether they're getting in or something like that, for example.
Yep.
How do you get them to choose door three as opposed to door five? and behind door three is a honey net that is fully instrumented, and you can work out what the hell they're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas door five actually is the one you don't know about. So it's that psychology of the adversary, not just the psychology of the defenders. And I think that we can have a lot of fun in that space. Mm-hmm. But again, it's coming down to this on the human element. When we look across the industry, have we got the right sort of skill sets to be thinking like this? So not just the leadership to say, hey, let's do this, but also the right skill sets, because traditionally cybersecurity has really come from the very technical disciplines. Mm-hmm. Have we got the right balance between the technical and non-technical to be able to sort of really drive this and evolve this?
That's the big challenge. Let me give you an industry perspective. Most cybersecurity companies are very much focused on the tech, very much focused on software development, you know, with in their development and R&D. But I think what you're seeing now is much more embracing the behavioral psychologists and the clinical folks to be able to provide that. Certainly within Forcepoint, we've brought on, a number of behavioral and clinical psychologists to help us with the human element and understanding and providing an understanding of what are the right things that we should be looking at, what are the questions we're trying to ask. So I think that the industry is coming around to that. I think the challenge is that there's just not enough cyber professionals out there. I think we think that they all have to have four-year degrees and are coders and things like that. And I don't think that that's in fact the case. I think this is a major challenge, almost a national security challenge for us here, certainly in the U.S. as well as abroad, to have enough people that understand this and that are not just the technical side of things, but understand the human side of things, I think is something that we have to address. And it's not a technology problem, and it's not an industry problem. It's a industry and academia and government working together to come up with innovative solutions to address this challenge. So whether it's a cyber civil service or a National Guard per se, that whether it's looking at the requirements for professionals in this area and say, okay, maybe there's vocational ways of getting there, and it doesn't require a four-year degree to achieve a certification in this, and come at this in a lot of different ways. But I absolutely agree. This is a lot more deep than just a technical or developer or a technical approach to the resource challenge that we have here. This is, covers the gambit from psychology to technical to any number of aspects that are going to truly have an impact as we look at the challenge that we're faced with.
I find it fascinating that, and I see it sort of now and again, hopefully I think sort of slightly less more than I used to, which is that some people giving the perspective that the ticket for entry to a cybersecurity job is a technical degree and being able to build a network and code. There are so many jobs out there that we need filling that.
Millions.
If that is the barrier for entry, then actually we've got a real challenge. But you don't necessarily need to be able to do that. You need to be able to talk language and translate across the disciplines that you're working with. But there are other elements in there that absolutely can help. And we certainly see that with the cyber strategy challenge that the Atlantic Council runs. So it's the Cyber 912 challenge, where there is no requirement on what discipline you're studying to do the competition. And it's strategy, policy, technical, international relations, the whole lot. And for example, the one we've got in the UK coming up, we've got a 50-50 gender split. Having not mandated any gender requirements within the teams, because we're drawing from humanities, arts, international relations, lots of different types of disciplines, it just naturally increases diversity.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge of the cybersecurity challenge out there is an extremely diverse challenge, and therefore you need an extremely diverse mindset to be able to go after these problems, and it's not just a technical problem, as you called out.
You see, now that I think is a great way to wrap up the podcast. Sean, thank you. That's been a great conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for listening today. I think we've covered a lot of ground on the human element of cybersecurity. It's considerably more complex than just thinking about the human element being just awareness of people within the organization. From the conversation that we've had with everybody, it really touches on everything, how we do cybersecurity, how we think about the adversary, how we look at training, how we look at education, and everything in between. And I think all the contributors will agree that there's lots of really good opportunity out there to really be tapped into by thinking more about the human element of cybersecurity. Thanks for listening to the Digital Statecraft, Digital Streetcraft podcast on the human element of cybersecurity. And I'm Pete Cooper.